Well, today I'd like to thank my son Nolan for giving me the idea for this sermon. Nolan reads to me every night. I know normally it's the parent that reads to the child, but Nolan reads to me. We have a book that we're reading called 12 Unlikely Heroes of the Bible, of course, by John MacArthur. And one of them is Miriam. And I really enjoyed that chapter when we read about Miriam, and that gave me the inspiration for the sermon. And as luck would have it, I noticed this week I subscribed to one of the church emails called This is the Way. Any of you subscribe to that? And I think it was Wednesday, the subject of the email was Miriam. So it seemed like all points were converging on Miriam. Not only my reading with Nolan, but also that church email. So I'd like to talk about Miriam today. We'll talk about a little background, but we want to get to one specific event in her life. And if you're familiar with her story, you might anticipate what we're going to talk about. Of course, that's the episode when she was struck with leprosy by God for something that she did. We'll get to that in a little bit. But first, I want to just talk about a little background of her life and think about it, and then we'll get to that one episode. So first of all, of course, she was the sister of Moses and Aaron, as we know. And she was right there at the beginning when Moses' mother put Moses in the basket, put him in the river, and then was found by the Pharaoh's daughter. And, of course, we know the story in Exodus 2. She was there watching and went up to the Pharaoh's daughter, to the princess, and said, would you like a nursemaid for that little baby boy? And, sure enough, she said yes, and then she was actually able to bring her back to her mother. So as Moses then was raised in the palace, if you will, of the Pharaoh, she was there all that time living as still as a slave with her people for, some 40 years until Moses fled, as we know in the story, at about age 40. She was about 7 years older than Moses, so she would have been 47. Moses would have been 40. Aaron was 43. Aaron was 3 years older, so Miriam was the eldest, and then Aaron, and then Moses. So Moses was the third born, which I am as well, so I know how that goes. I'm the third child. Now, Josephus writes that Miriam was married to Hur. We don't know that for sure, but it certainly is a possibility that that is the case. And if it was, it's interesting that just the part that Miriam had to play, there's the story of when the Israelites were fighting the Amalekites. Remember that one where they're fighting? And as long as Moses held up his hands with the staff, they prevailed. When he got tired and his hands were lowered, they would begin to lose. And so Aaron and Hur held up his hands so they all day so that they would continue to prevail. Well, that may have been Miriam's husband. And later on in the book of Exodus, there's another place where it mentions that Hur was in sort of a leadership position along with Aaron with Moses. And there's actually in Micah, I'll just note this if you want to note it, in Micah 6 and verse 4, there's a mention that God sent before you, speaking to Israel, sent Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. So Miriam is kind of included with those three as, part of the ones who led Israel out of bondage and who God used in that purpose. So she certainly was a hero and a big part to play in leading the people out of the Exodus, or in the Exodus, leading the people out of Egypt, and that God was able to use. In Exodus 15 and verse 20, she's called a prophetess, the only woman to that point that was called a prophetess in the Bible. That's Exodus 15 and verse 20. Now in Numbers 12, and we'll come back to Numbers 12 in a little bit, that's the episode where Miriam actually speaks against her younger brother, Moses, and is struck with leprosy. We'll come back to Numbers 12 in a little bit. Now, that's kind of natural. She's the oldest daughter. I had an older daughter, and she would speak against me from time to time, so it's kind of natural, perhaps. Now, Miriam actually eventually died at Kadesh in that last year before Israel was actually able to go into the land, finally, at the end of all that wandering in the desert. She and Moses and Aaron actually all died in the same year. I don't know if you noticed that before. I hadn't noticed it, kind of added up the years before, but they all died right at the end there before going into the land. So Moses that's easy to remember. He was kind of 40 years in Egypt, 40 years as in Midian herding the sheep, and then 40 years after that leading them out, wandering in the desert, and then finally died before going into the land. Miriam died that same year, so she would have been 127. And then Aaron as well, he was 123. So need to sort of picture Miriam the way she really was. In the movies, of course, she's like a little girl all throughout. Well, she would have been a grandmother, an octogenarian at the time of the Exodus, certainly at least 80 years old, 87, and then was quite old by the time they're wandering in the desert and when she did die. So that's kind of the background of Miriam, just to refresh our memory. Let's go to the story that I want to focus on today and draw a lesson from in Numbers 12. And I always think of when we study an example like this of what Paul said, these things were written for us, not just for entertainment or so that Disney could make movies out of them. He didn't say that about Disney, but he might have if he had known. But they're really written for us to learn from. So I want to do that today as we go to Numbers 12. So let's start by reading that chapter, Numbers 12, and we'll read verses 1 through 16. So Numbers 12 and verse 1, then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses. So they both came together, but it certainly seems that Miriam was the leader in this. She was punished in a greater way. Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman who he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman. Now there's debate about who this is really referring to. Was it another wife that he had before Zipporah, or was it Zipporah, and this was really referring to her? We don't really know, and it's really not relevant because that really wasn't the point. As we read on here, that's not really what Miriam was talking about. Her real point here is revealed in verse 2. She says, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also? Kind of picturing the firstborn, you know, older daughter saying this. Who do you think you are? What about me? Isn't God speaking through us as well? The rest of this verse, and the Lord heard it. Now the man Moses was very humble, more than all men who were on the face of the earth. It doesn't say what Moses said here, but he might have said, knowing what might come next, he might have said, yikes. I just had to say that, nothing to do with the sermon, but just to honor Mr. Burbeck, I've been wanting to say that since he said that in his sermon a couple weeks ago. So maybe Moses said, you know, yikes, what's going to happen next? After that, God's not going to be pleased with that. And of course he wasn't. Verse 4. Suddenly the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, come out, you three, to the tabernacle of meeting. So the three came out. Then the Lord came down in the pillar of cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle and called Aaron and Miriam, and they both went forward. Then he said, hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak to him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. I speak with him face to face, even plainly, and not in dark sayings. And he sees the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? Verse 9. So the anger of the Lord was aroused against them, and he departed. And when the cloud departed from above the tabernacle, suddenly Miriam became leprous, as white as snow. Then Aaron turned toward Miriam, and there she was, a leper. So Aaron said to Moses, oh, my Lord, please do not lay this sin on us in which we have done foolishly, in which we have sinned. Please don't let her be as one dead whose flesh is half consumed when he comes out of his mother's womb. Now, God didn't strike Aaron with leprosy. Whether that's because Miriam was really leading this or not, we don't know for sure. It could also be because Aaron was the high priest. So for him to have a condition like this would have left him impure and unable to perform his duties. So maybe God chose not to do that for that reason. Whatever the reason was, God punished Miriam with this. So continuing, verse 13. So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, please heal her, O God, I pray. Then the Lord said to Moses, if her father had but spit in her face, would she not be shamed 7 days? Let her be shut out of the camp 7 days, and afterwards she may be received again. I don't know all the derivation of this particular custom, but we'll leave that for another time. Let's just keep going. Verse 15, so Miriam was shut out of the camp 7 days, and the people did not journey until Miriam was brought in again. So this would have been well known it was, you know, a kind of a public thing that happened. The people would have known about it. And they stayed there for 7 days until she was healed and came back in. And afterward, verse 16, the people moved on from Hazeroth to the wilderness of Paran. So that's the episode. Now, one thing I want to note here, and I read that last verse because it helps us to link to why did this happen. Note that it says they moved on from Hazeroth. So what led to this situation happening with Miriam? Now, maybe this was something that was longstanding for many years, perhaps. Miriam maybe was thinking about, what about me? I don't know. But it's interesting, there were some incidents that happened right before this in chapter 11, and that we can see that link to Hazeroth, that happened at Hazeroth back in chapter 11. So let's look to 11. We won't read all of chapter 11, but let's read part of it. I want to go to verse 35. Chapter 11 and verse 35. So this is the end of that chapter. Whoops, I went to the wrong place. I went to Numbers 35. I want to go to chapter 11, verse 35. So we know just the last verse of this previous chapter says the people moved to Hazeroth and camped at Hazeroth. So that's where this happened with Miriam, right after they had gone from this previous place. So let's read what happened in that previous chapter that may have had something to play with this. So let's go to chapter 11, verse 16. I want to read verses 16 and 17 of chapter 11 as we try to figure out what may have led to this happening with Miriam. Verse 16. Now, I won't read the verses before this, but basically Moses complained to God and said, I can't take it anymore. These people are driving me nuts. It's my paraphrase version. They were complaining, just went on and on. If you're a parent, you can relate to this. Sometimes it just gets to be too much, and you just can't take it anymore, and you just want to be relieved of the burden. And that's what Moses kind of did. People were complaining and murmuring, and Moses complained to God. Just one editorial note I'll mention there is, if you're going to complain, better to complain to God directly. There's no punishment said here for Moses complaining to God, whereas the people were punished from time to time throughout the book of Numbers as they complained. But God didn't say, Moses, why did you complain to me? If you have a complaint, take it to God directly instead of sort of talking to other people. I think that's a principle even for us today. If we have a problem with Mr. Shaw, for instance, as our pastor, you know, go talk to him. Don't talk to Mr. Wickman and say, hear what that Shaw guy's doing? That's not the right principle. We need to take it directly, and that's the example we see here in Numbers 11. Well, let's get to the story here. So after this, God hears Moses, hears that complaint, says, okay, yes, I have a solution for that. He says in verse 16, gather to me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom you know to be elders of the people and officers over them. Bring them to the tabernacle of meeting, that they may stand there with you. Then I will come down and talk with you there. I will take of the spirit that is upon you, and will put the same upon them. This is the spirit of God, of course. And they shall bear the burden of the people with you, that you may not bear it yourself alone. Then you shall say to the people, consecrate yourselves. I'm sorry, I don't want to read that part. That's the part about that he brings meat. We'll skip that part. Let's just skip down to verses 24 and 25. So he actually does it. Verse 24. So Moses went out and told the people the words of the Lord, and he gathered the 70 men, these 70 elders, and placed them around the tabernacle. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and spoke to him and took of the spirit that was upon him, on Moses, and placed the same upon the 70 elders. And it happened when the spirit rested upon them that they prophesied, although they never did so again. So I see that. What happened right after that? This incident with Miriam happened right after it. So I ask, why? What led Miriam to do what she did? So a couple possibilities. Did she somehow resent Moses sharing his responsibility with these 70 elders? You know, was it kind of a cozy little structure with Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, and she kind of resented sort of letting that go out further? Did she resent that in some way? Did she resent them prophesying? You know, she was called the prophetess. Did she have sort of a jealousy about, you know, holding that to herself? You know, maybe even a family situation. I mentioned she was the firstborn, and I'm not a firstborn, but some of you who are, you might know, tend to be kind of bossy. My wife's a firstborn, so she would know. I know some of you are, just by percentages. There must be some out there. I won't ask you to raise your hand. But I was, as I said, I was third, so I was like a Moses. And I'm used to being told what to do by my older sister and older brother. And you kind of resent that. Or if a younger rises above the elder, there can be some resentment there. Was that the reason? Perhaps. Maybe it was all some of that mixed together. Whatever the case, what was the sin of Miriam? Let's just make sure we note that again. Let's go to chapter 12 and verse 2. If you had to put one word on it, what would we describe her sin as? Let's just read verse 2 again. What did she say? Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also? In other words, me? You know, what about me? You're raising and elevating these other people. What about me? What is that attitude? I would characterize that as envy, jealousy, self-seeking, really an attitude of self. And that's a wrong example. There are plenty of places in the Bible where that's mentioned. We shouldn't be focused on ourselves and what we want and, you know, elevating ourselves in status and recognition and those things. We should be looking in a more selfish way for others. And that was the problem for Miriam. Now, what about you and me? We can think about, I'm sure we could come up with examples of things we've done or things we go through. Have you ever been maybe in a work environment? Have you been overlooked for promotion? Somebody else gets promotion. What is the natural human reaction to that? We would tend to think, well, why not me? Just like Miriam said, has he not spoken through me also? Am I not capable of doing that? Why am I not recognized and elevated? I'm sure that we've recognized that in a work situation. How about just, maybe it's not a promotion example, but just seeing someone else succeed. What is our reaction? Do we fully 100% in our hearts fully want to congratulate them and think well of them and be happy for them that they succeeded? Or does part of us think, you know, that could be me. Why am I not up there? You know, we heard Mr. Randall singing in the choir, his beautiful tenor voice. We could think either that's great and wonderful that he has that voice that he can, you know, offer that to God, or we can think, well, what about me? I've got a tenor voice as well. Maybe I could do that. Where's Mr. Randall? I'm looking for him. Or he has, you know, that beautiful hair. You know, I could wish. There he is. Yeah. You know, he's got that beautiful hair, and I've got none of that. Whatever it is, I mean, we can see somebody else, and we can, maybe that's a beautiful person, so I'm going to go on for Mr. Randall, find somebody else that's beautiful, and think, well, why not me? Why don't I have that? Are we happy for someone else, or in our heart, do we resent and feel jealousy and envy of them? That's a human reaction. That's our human nature at work. Now, it could also be just disagreeing with people, and we see that throughout the book of Numbers, just when those who are in a leadership position make certain things, we resent it, we're jealous of that, we envy that, and we think, I don't want to do that, and start to resent it and allow jealousy and envy to come forward. And maybe part of that was the case with Miriam as well. What about just complaining? Again, I think of that goes throughout the book of Numbers. And focusing on the negative, starting to get sort of, you know, focused on ourselves and our own attitude. I don't want to do what someone else is leading me toward. I'm resenting that. Maybe it's with our spouse or a boss or something like that. We just become resentful. At the core, that's an attitude of it's all about me. It's about myself and what I want and not what someone else wants. So those are all possibilities we can think of in our own lives that this applies to. And no matter what it is, that's a wrong attitude that we have. And it's hard. It's hard to work on. What would we want instead? What attitude would be a godly attitude that's the contrast? I always think of the continuum. So if over here is sort of this selfish, self-seeking, envy, jealousy, that sort of thing, what's on the other end of the spectrum? What would that be? I actually thought about this a lot. What word would I put on that? Now we have a perfect example of it right there in the previous chapter with Moses, and I'd like to read that. I skipped over that as we read before, but there's a perfect example of this right after this episode of the 70 elders in verse 26. Let's read verse 26 through 30. Chapter 11, 26. So the 70 had had God's Spirit placed on them, had come around the tabernacle, but it was actually 68. There were two missing. Verse 26, we see this. Two men had remained in the camp. The name of one was Eldad, and the name of the other, Medad. They remained just so they could get their names in the book. Otherwise, it would have just been the 70. But now we all know who Medad and Eldad are. I don't know. I have no idea why they stayed behind, why they didn't go. God didn't punish them. Maybe they were taking a shower. I don't know what you do in the desert. Whatever it was, they didn't make it. But they were in the camp. But they were among those listed, and they had not gone to the tabernacle, yet they prophesied in the camp. So obviously God put his Spirit on them, just like the 68 who had made it to the tabernacle. So now we see what happened. Verse 27. A young man ran and told Moses and said, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. So Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, one of his choice men, answered and said, Moses, my Lord, forbid them. Put a stop to that. They shouldn't be doing that. What was Moses' answer? This is the perfect example here of the opposite, the continuum from what we saw in Miriam in the next chapter. If we wanted to really seek the attitude, the mind of Christ, this is what we want to exhibit, what Moses did here in verse 29. It's a key verse, verse 29. Then Moses said to him, are you zealous or jealous or envious for my sake? That's really what that word means. Are you jealous of my status and reputation? He goes on to say, oh, that all the Lord's people were prophets and that the Lord would put his Spirit upon them. Oh, that everybody, I wish God would put his Spirit on all these 600,000 men, plus all the women and children. I wish God's Spirit would be on all of them and change their heart. That was Moses' attitude. He didn't want to hold that to himself and sort of put a box around this special relationship that he had with God. He would have loved to see that shared with everybody. What would we call that? I would call it selflessness. Selflessness. Instead of self-seeking, focus on self. Really an outward focus on others, wanting for other people. So it's a perfect example. Now when I read this, this is really what got me interested in speaking on this topic. I read this and I thought, well, I want to be that. How do I be that? That's hard. Where can I find elsewhere in the Bible to actually learn to develop that attitude that Moses had instead of what we see in chapter 12 with Miriam? And by the way, I'm not just meaning to pick on Miriam. Appreciate her story being written for an example and, you know, wonderful lady and a wonderful leader for the people of Israel. But she did make that one mistake, and it was written down so that we could learn from it, as Paul said. So how can we have the attitude that Moses did, that heart inside of selflessness and really wanting to share with other people? How can we have that attitude and not fall prey to the self-seeking envy that Miriam had? Well, I looked in a lot of places, and where I finally came down to was the book of James. And so that's where I want to go to now, James 3. James is a wonderful pastor. Tradition has it that he was the pastor of the Jerusalem church for probably 3 decades, some 30 years. He was the brother of Jesus Christ. And a wonderful example of just practical living all throughout the book of James. Of course, there's the verses about the tongue and the problem that is, the words that we say. And here's another example in James 3 where he talks about this exact issue that we just read about with Miriam and Moses. So I want to focus on this short little passage. We'll be looking at verses 13 through 18 in James 3. I think it'll help us do two things. Number one, understand the problem. What's the source of this kind of attitude? And then once we've understood that, James doesn't leave it there. He's a good pastor. He helps with the solution. What is the solution? How can we develop the right attitude and not the wrong one? So let's look at James 3. Let's start off by just reading that. So let's get over to James 3, and we'll start by reading that whole passage. James 3, verses 13 to 18. Now this is right after, earlier in the chapter, he's talking about the tongue and how it can be like a blazing fire and get out of control and all of that. But his next verse here is about this attitude of envy and self-seeking. So starting at verse 13, James 3. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. Sounds like Moses. But, verse 14, if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. So that's where I want to focus on that whole passage. There's some great truth in there of how we can learn to avoid this problem. Now, first of all, the definition there, James really defines it in verses 14 through 16. And he says the exact words, bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts. It sounds exactly like what we just read with Miriam. And the result of it is exactly what we saw over in Numbers, verse 16. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. That word that's translated confusion is actually, the Greek word there could be translated as insurrection, you know, like a political insurrection. And it actually is used for situations like anarchy and political turmoil in other parts of the New Testament. And that's really what was going on there with Miriam. It was like a political insurrection, like what we see in Egypt happening right now, or U.S. politics. We just see envy, you know, back and forth. It's like political campaign commercials, just arguments and envy and jealousy. That is not the way of God. That is not the wisdom from above. That is not the right way of living. Now, I do want to just take a moment and talk about wisdom. He refers to this as wisdom from above. And that may not be a familiar way of referring to this. So I'd like to just read Proverbs in this context of what does this mean, the wisdom from above? What is James referring to? And I think we can see that in Proverbs 2. So let's just take a moment and we'll go sideways over to Proverbs 2. And we'll read verses 6 through 16. Just so we have in our minds, what is James meaning when he says wisdom? What does he mean by that? Proverbs 2, verses 6 through 13. We want to look in the Bible to see what is that referring to. Proverbs 2, verse 6. For the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield to those who walk uprightly. He guards the paths of justice and preserves the way of his saints. Then you will understand righteousness and justice, equity and every good path, when wisdom enters your heart and knowledge is pleasant to your soul. Discretion will preserve you. Understanding will keep you to deliver you from the way of evil, from the man who speaks perverse things, from those who leave the paths of uprightness to walk in the ways of darkness. His point here is it's the way you walk. It's your actions. That's what wisdom really is, following the way of God. And I think that reflects everything that James is talking about in this entire book. It's about what you do in your life, not talking the talk, but walking the walk. That is wisdom, really walking in the path, the right ways of God. So that's what we're talking about when wisdom. Let's go back to James 3 then. We'll go back to James 3 and let's look at verse 15. Again, it's really zero in on what is the problem. What is the source of the origin of this attitude? And James really nails it here in verse 15. Let's read verse 15 again. This wisdom, in other words, the wrong attitude, bitter envy and self-seeking, does not descend from above. In other words, this is not the way of God, but it is earthly, sensual, and demonic. Now, what do those words mean? Let's take a moment to think about that. Jameson Fawson Brown, the commentary, has a great way of describing this. He referred to this as three things: of the world, of the flesh, and of the devil. I'll just read a little bit in his commentary about these three words. So first of all, earthly, this attitude, earthly. This would be as opposed to heavenly, or, you know, the way of God. I really, as I thought about this, I thought of Mr. Shaw several years ago at the feast gave a sermon about having the eternal mindset. So instead of having sort of our minds on this physical plane of this world and this earth, you know, focused on God and really his eternity and his way and not being sort of stuck here and just looking at the world, our minds just dominated by what's going on in the world around us and the natural world. We don't want to be dominated by that way of thinking. We want to have a mindset that's focused on God and what he wants in this life and not just the natural world around us. So that's what that first one means, earthly. And that the commentary, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown refers to that as, in a simple way, I think of the world. It's the world, the worldliness around us. The second one is very interesting too. It's translated as sensual. I'm not sure that's a very good translation for us to understand. I don't really know what that means until I look into the definition of the word. And the commentary mentions that's literally, it means animal-like. It's like an animal. It's like, you know, we are based genetically as being like an animal, but we are more than that. God creates us to be more than just animals. But the characteristic here is someone is just driven by animal instinct, if you will, not the choosing the right way that God has given us to be. And I think of a program I heard on NPR yesterday by a Jewish rabbi. He was talking about this. He was actually referring to Yom Kippur and why people fast on the Day of Atonement. And he said, what that really represents is making the choice to not be an animal. Our animal instinct is when we're hungry, we eat, right? An animal is not going to make the choice to say, I'm hungry, but I'm not going to eat. But we, on the Day of Atonement and certainly in other parts of our lives, we make the choice that my animal drive, if I were just an animal, would be to take what I want. Or, you know, if there's food there and I'm hungry, I'm going to eat it. But we actually take the free will that God has given us and choose not to do something, to actually constrain ourselves and obey him. And that's really what this second word is getting at. It's of the flesh or just an animal perspective. And there are many ways beyond eating in our lives that, you know, we want to do something. We see something we want. We could just take it and steal it if it, you know, there's some money on the table. We make a conscious choice using our free will that God has given us to choose not to do that. That is the opposite of this attitude here that James is talking about of being sensual or animal-like. The third word there, of course, is demonic, which just means the origin of this attitude is Satan and his attitude of rebellion. It's of that character of Satan. And then the commentary here sums this all up saying these three things are really the three spiritual foes of man, the world, the flesh, and the devil. So those are the three characteristics. And that's really what was driving Miriam in that story that we looked at. And we see the consequences of what happened, and they're pretty serious. If we look at James 3 and verse 16, we see the result of this attitude. Verse 16 of James 3, for where envy and self-seeking exist, the result is confusion and every evil thing. And as soon as I read that verse, I thought of Numbers. I don't know if you ever studied the book of Numbers. It's actually an intriguing study to go around and actually read all the chapters. I hadn't read it for many years, so when I was studying this, I started reading around. It's a little hard to follow without a commentary to kind of guide you. It seems like kind of a patchwork. So it helps to get a study guide to kind of lead you through the book of Numbers. But it is fascinating. There's a whole series of bad things that happen in Numbers as the people are coming close now after these 40 years of wandering in the desert, finally able to enter the land. And you think, now it's finally the time. But yet you see these, you know, mistake after mistake. There's complaining, grumbling, that they're lusting after food. God gives them meat, quail. And as I thought of this, I went through and I kind of categorized in a little table here the different things that happen. And each one of these, I can kind of see the characteristics that James was talking about. Earthly, of the world, of the flesh, and of the devil. I'll just kind of run these through. I'm not going to go to the detail now, but you might look at Numbers sometime and think about these characteristics that were driving the human nature of these of the Israelites as they were rebelling against God in the desert. Chapter 11, they were complaining, grumbling, murmuring against Moses. God brought fire upon them. Later in chapter 11, they were hungry. They said, I'm sick of this manna, this, you know, boring bread. Give me some meat to eat. I wish I could go back to Egypt. I had all the meat, you know, cucumbers, all that good stuff. God said, okay, I'll give you meat to eat. And he brought down quail. I was amazed by the numbers. If you read the amount that it says that they had, it says each man gathered no less than 70 bushels of quail. Can you imagine that? 70, but you know, a bushel is like, any of you been on a farm community and gathered fruit or something and put it in a bushel? A bushel basket's like this tall and this wide. 70 of those. I don't know what they did with it to keep it from rotting. Maybe they hung it up to dry or whatever, but they were just so, that was a lot of quail that God brought to the camp. Anyway, it was just this lusting, this animal-like instinct that I'm starving, I have to have meat. And then, of course, God punished them as well. Now, it got more serious than that. We start to see really the attribute of the devil as we go into the next few things. We see the insurrection that we just read about from Miriam in chapter 12. There's the episode of the spies in chapter 13 and 14 where they were going to enter the land, but the spy, they were afraid, the people were too big, they couldn't do it, they had lack of faith in God, and they were punished to have to wander in the desert for 40 more years. Chapter 16 is the famous example, kind of a carry-on from Miriam. First we see Miriam, the sister of Moses, rebel against him. That must have been hard. His own sister and brother sort of attacking him and causing rebellion. And it just kept on from there. We see in chapter 16 the famous example of Korah's rebellion or his insurrection. Again, the common thread here is rebellion. That's an attribute of Satan. It's of the devil. And then, of course, the ultimate one is in chapter 25. After all of this, 40 years of wandering, that whole generation died. They're finally almost able to enter the land. And what happens? Right on the doorstep of the promised land, entering in, they fall into this horrible sin with the Midianites and the at Baal Peor, they get into sexual immorality with the women of the Midianites, commit horrible idolatry. I won't actually read it because it's a little it's kind of hard to read in a public setting. But there's actually the example of the woman and the man who were committing a sexual act, perhaps even at the door of the tabernacle. Maybe in kind of a almost like an idolatrous worship point of view. You talk about rebellion. I mean, it was just completely rebelling against God right on the doorstep of going into the promised land. That's how serious the consequence of this attitude is. So if we think about this and think, well, it's not that big of a deal, just a little tiff between Miriam and her brother, it's a little more serious than that, and it can be for us as well. Ultimately, it can lead to this outright rebellion against God. That's what we see in the book of the whole book of Numbers, really throughout. So naturally, after I think about all that seems kind of depressing. I think in my mind, well, I want to avoid that kind of an attitude. It's absolutely rebelling against God. How can I change that? What's the solution to that? How can we change our heart to have the godly attitude of selflessness? And by the way, it's not just the absence of self-seeking. Again, I think of this continuum. Self-seeking over here and selflessness over here. It's not neutral. I think of neutral might be like just indifferent. Well, I don't really care. But I'm not going to like be envious of you, but I'll just be indifferent to you. That's not enough. That's moving toward away from being envious and jealous, but that's not far enough to get over to the true attitude that Moses had and that God would want us to have, which is selflessness and really caring about what happens to other people. So it's more than just being indifferent. It's about really developing an attitude of caring for other people in a selfless way. So how can we change our hearts to have this godly attitude of selflessness and really caring about other people? Well, James is a great pastor, and he doesn't leave us just presenting the problem and saying, well, there's nothing you can do about it. He tells us how. And that's where I'd like to finish up here. If we go back to James 3, in verse 17, we see the formula for combating this problem. So let's go back to James 3 now. And verse 17. So verse 17, in contrast, just the verse before he said, for where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion or insurrection and every evil thing are there. But verse 17, here's the answer. But the wisdom that is above, that is from above, in other words, the way of God, the way of acting in the way that we should with our heart converted to God, that way is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits without partiality and without hypocrisy. And then the fruit of that, as opposed to bitter envy and self-seeking, which was confusion, insurrection, every evil thing, the fruit of this is sown in peace by those who make peace in verse 18. So let's take a few minutes to go through these attributes and talk about them. This is really the pathway to having the right attitude and changing our hearts and converting our hearts as God would have us to in caring for other people. Now, I'd like to take the time to really dig in more deeply on each one of these, and I can imagine this is probably condensed in the book of James from a sermon series that James put on back in the Jerusalem church in the summer of 45 AD in the first century. I'm making that up. But, you know, I could see James actually, he probably had sermons where he dug into these very deeply in each one, and I'd love to hear those some days. In the kingdom, I'd like to go to James and say, I'd like to hear the sermon that you gave on being peaceable, the sermon you gave on being gentle, on being willing to yield, full of mercy. And I bet he had sermons where he dug into each one of those. We won't be able to do that today. We're just going to highlight in a quick summary each of these attributes as he did here in chapter 3. But I really think of this as the mirror. Remember where James refers to the looking in the mirror, the Word of God? I think it's over here in chapter 1. Let's go over to chapter 1 of James. I think it's toward the end of the chapter. Here it is, James 1 and verse 22. Let's read this before we go through this list and think about how we would use this list of godly attributes. We have to look in the mirror. Verse 22 of chapter 1. Be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man observing his natural self in his natural face in a mirror. For he observes himself, goes away, and immediately forgets what kind of man he was. In other words, he looks in the mirror and says, I've got some things I need to work on here, but then he just turns away and I just forget. Sounds like a Doctor Who episode. My son and I also watch Doctor Who. I'm not recommending the show necessarily, but we watch it. Anyway, there was a creature that, if you looked at it, it was this monster of some sort, and some sort of space alien. And if you looked at it, as soon as you looked away, you'd totally forget it. And it was just like you'd never seen it. And so it was kind of hard to combat this particular alien, because as soon as you turned around, you know, the good guys on the show completely forgot about the alien. I don't know why I brought that up, but it's like this picture of like looking in the mirror, and then you turn around and completely forgot that there was something I needed to work on and change in myself when I was looking in the mirror. Verse 25, he who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in other words, really looks at the word of God and says, I need to change something, this one will be blessed in what he does. And that's really what I think we see here over in chapter 3 and verse 17. We see some items from God's law that we need to change and make part of ourselves when we look at ourselves in the mirror. I think of maybe, you know, having these as stickers on the bathroom mirror. So every morning when we get up, we look and see, how am I doing in being pure? How am I doing in being peaceable, in being gentle with other people? And evaluate myself and really work on it, changing myself according to God's way, and not just being, like we heard earlier, just like being an animal, being sensual, and just, well, however I am is just too bad. That's the way I am. James is counseling us to really change ourselves according to these attributes. So let's work through these. Let's start with pure, number one. True godly wisdom is pure. The word here in the Greek is hagnos, which just means completely clean and pure. In other words, there's the complete absence of any sinful attitude or motive. There's not anything in there that's not pure. We don't have any of that. That's what that word means. based on the Word of God, which is completely true and pure, without error. And you know, it's important to think that there is no lasting peace. We see that in verse 18. We can't have true peace until we have purity based on God's Word. When we base our lives on God's Word, then we can achieve peace. That's part of what James is saying here. So the first attribute is pure. Purity based, your life is pure based on God's Word. And then everything else proceeds from that. All these other attributes proceed out of that purity of living our lives according to God's way. So the wisdom that is from above is first pure, and then it is peaceable. The word there is means peaceable or loving peace. And true wisdom, the wisdom from above, leads to peace and harmony, not as we saw there with bitter envy and self-seeking, leading to discord and disputing. And think of the mirror again. If we look in the mirror and we look at ourselves each day and we see, you know, just kind of going around, there's just like this black cloud over us. And when I go and I talk to Mr. Wickman, this black cloud is kind of between us. And all of a sudden we're disputing. He was fine before I showed up, but now we're in a dispute. And I just see myself. Everywhere I go, it seems like I'm in an argument. If that's the way it is, we need to look in the mirror and say, I need to change something. Sorry to pick on Mr. Wickman, but it could be anybody. You know, if disputing is kind of characteristic of ourselves, everywhere we go, we seem to be getting into an argument. That is the wisdom from below, not the wisdom from above. We need to really look in the mirror and say, I need to change the way I act. We must love peace. We must be peaceable. In any situation where conflict might arise, we have to think about the consequence of our action. Is something that we're doing causing disputes all the time, or do we need to change and think, you know, maybe sometimes instead of trying to get my way, if I think that may cause just conflict, maybe I can just back up a little bit. We see that a little bit down the line here in the other attributes of being willing to yield. Do we always have to have our own way, even when it causes conflict instead of peace? If we really love peace, we're willing to yield and back up and say, you know, for the sake of peace, I'm not going to seek my own way. And it could be any little thing in your life with someone that you're having conflict with. It could be in my closet. I was just thinking this morning, this is trivial, I'm just going to be silly here for a moment. There's always a short supply of hangers in my closet, in my wife and my closet. Because the extra hangers go out in the hallway in the room where the washing machine and dryer are. And so there's no extras in the closet. So my clothes are on one side and her clothes are on the other. And if I take something off of a hanger, all of a sudden I come back to hang my coat back up and the hanger's gone. So now there are extra hangers right around the corner in the hallway that I can just go get, and that would lead to peace. Or I could start a fight over it and say, why'd you take my hanger? Or I could take her coat off the hanger, throw it on the floor, and then put my coat on it and put it back up. I'm going to get in trouble for this later. That's totally silly. It means nothing. But the point, I mean, just for a silly example, that's the kind of thing that we can get into. Just little things that we just kind of jab at other people. Not really bad, but just kind of poke them. They're not leading to peace. Now, there can be more serious things than that. That's a trivial example. But, you know, pretty soon we're, you know, Israel and Palestine just like lobbing shells at each other. That's where wars come from, as James says later on. The point there is peace. Think about our actions. Do they lead to peace instead of strife and argument? Okay, after that, at first is purity, then we have being peaceable. The next one is gentle. Godly wisdom is gentle and considerate of others, not just focus on self. Again, you know, self-seeking, really the core of that is the world revolves around me. It's all about me. It's like, you know, like a child. If any of you observe small children, they grow up at first, their world is, they are at the center of it. Everyone is there to serve them. Parents, the dog, everything is just the mailman. Everything is there to serve their needs. That's the way a child is. We're supposed to grow up from that. Godly wisdom is gentle and considerate of others. The Greek word there means willing to yield and considerate. considerate of others, and gentle and kind. So again, when we interact with others, are we obstinate and just always trying to force our own way and get our way? Or are we gentle and, as the next word says, willing to yield and not necessarily get our way? Or are we just rough? Again, I talked earlier about like going around with a black cloud over your head. If we're not careful, sometimes we can go around and just be rough. That's kind of the opposite of gentle. Well, I'm just a brat. That's who I am. I can't help it, right? The animal that I am, I'm just rough. And I just accidentally offend people everywhere I go. And that's really their problem. They just need to take me into account, right? That is not the way we want to be. It's not listed here. Being rough is not one of the examples here. We need to be gentle. Especially men can be this way, just to take the men for a moment. Now, the women can sometimes be rough as well, but certainly men, we can think, well, I'm just masculine and kind of go around like a bull in a china shop knocking people down. Not acceptable. We need to learn to be gentle, considerate of others, and kind to them. So that's gentleness. We need to learn to be gentle in how we treat other people. The fourth one is, after first pure, then peaceable, gentle, then is willing to yield. That means not to always get our own way. And again, that's the attitude of self, is that whenever there's something going on, I've got to have it my way. We see this, you know, with kids. My kids were playing games yesterday, and I noticed, you know, think about this with games. This always happens with kids when they're, whatever the game is, you know, the one wants to play it this way, the other wants to play it another way, and pretty soon it's like this, right? And you'd like to think, well, that's just kids, right? But adults can be the same way. We're just kind of kids grown up and a little bit older. We're more subtle about it, but if we're not careful, we're just like grown children and in that immaturity in the way that we act. We need to be willing to yield. That's God's Spirit working in us and changing our heart. Being willing to yield and not always having to get our own way. That is being considerate of others and being selfless. So now that's willing to yield. The next one is full of mercy and good fruits. Godly wisdom, the wisdom from above, is compassionate and ready and eager to help others. The Greek word there is eleos, which means compassionate. I love the way the King James sometimes translates this word in other places as not just mercy, but tender mercy. I think that's a great description. Just being tender with other people and compassionate. And I like the definition of the second part of that word, where it says, full of mercy and good fruits. The definition of that Greek word said fruit as plucked. I think that's a great thing to think about. It's like a ripe fruit, you know, not a green apple that you take a bite into and it's like, oh, that's awful. You know, it's sour. It's not ripe yet. It's not really good. But a ripe fruit that's really ready to be plucked is wonderful, right? A wonderful apple that's really ripe, nice and sweet, or a plum that's really just juicy when you bite into it. That's the picture here, is a ripe fruit that's just wonderful to be around. That's the way our life should be, like a well-ripened fruit. Wherever we go, it's just, we're a wonderful interaction with other people. And when wise people, those who have the wisdom from above, are full of mercy. They are not quick to judge or condemn other people. Instead, their lives are full of good fruits and this mercy that we just read about. The next one after that is partiality. It says, without partiality, godly wisdom is impartial. It doesn't show favoritism and discriminate against people. In other words, I'll give advantage to one person and then put another one down. Of course, that just leads to conflict when we do that, right? I mean, you think about where envy, back to verse 16, where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. And that's what happens when there's favoritism, the way we treat other people. It breeds resentment in other people. That could be in family relationships. You know, the worst thing we could do as a parent is to favor one child over another. And then the others feel naturally resentful of that. And the same thing is true of a family grown large, like in a church organization like this. We treat each other fairly and equitably and not showing impartiality or favoritism among ourselves. So that's impartiality. We can't have any of that in the wisdom from above. The final one is without hypocrisy. Godly wisdom is sincere with true motives. The word there means undissembled or sincere. And I think sincere is a little easier to follow than dissembled. That's not typically a word that we think about. But the King James translates this word in other places as without dissimulation or unfeigned. So it's like putting a mask on. If we're putting a mask on and not really being true and sincere in our attitude and what we say, pretty soon people pick that up and it breeds resentment. I think of when I read that last one, I think back to earlier in the chapter in verse 12 where James says, verse 11, does the spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? And he says, can a fig tree bear olives or a grapevine bear figs? I'm pretty sure Mr. Hofford has never seen his grapevines pop out with figs. It just isn't possible. It wouldn't make very good wine. Thus, no spring yields both salt water and fresh. You don't see like a spring coming up and there's salt water over here and there's fresh water over here. We don't want to be like that where, you know, sometimes we're salty and other times we're fresh. We want to always have fresh, wonderful water in terms of our relationship to other people and the way that we act out of our heart. We must always speak the truth and not have hypocrisy. Basically, always have the right, true attitude or motive in what we do. So as I said earlier, this list of words is a wonderful list, and it's really like a mirror that we hold up to ourselves and say, this is what I want to emulate to become like Christ, like what we saw in Moses back there in Numbers 11. And I love James because he's so practical. The whole book is that way. It's not sort of theory about some complicated construct. It's very simple and practical about the way that we act. It's about our lives reflecting God's nature in everything that we think, say, and do. And we have to actually do it. Again, it was ironic. I was listening to this program yesterday where this Jewish rabbi was talking about, and the commentator asked him about, what about this movement of people that are spiritual for this expression? Well, I reject organized religion. I'm just spiritual. And the quote he gave I thought was fascinating, said, spirituality really is about what people feel. Theology is about what we say. And religion is about what we do. And I think that just squares totally what Paul is saying. True religion is actually, it's about what we do and say to other people. And this verse is really like a mirror that we hold up to ourselves about how do we need to change to have that kind of attitude in ourselves. So let's begin to wrap up here about this attitude that we want to put that bad attitude of selfishness, self-seeking, envy, jealousy out of our lives and put the right attitude in. As I thought about concluding this, I thought, you know what this really reminds me of is like cancer. Some of you may have had experience with cancer. Cancer is a horrible thing. And it's kind of like this. Cancer starts small, but you know, cancer doesn't stay the same. Typically, it progresses, it gets worse and worse until it kills the body. It grows out of control, and it gets worse and worse. And envy and self-seeking is that way. I think of when I was thinking about reading the book of Numbers, where we see this attitude kind of like a thread going through that book and the children of Israel in the desert. It just got worse and worse and worse until they almost failed to go into the land by completely rebelling against God. And on the one hand, Numbers is a discouraging book because you read it and you think, how could they just have mistake after mistake and God had to punish them? But yet, on the other hand, what tremendous mercy God had that he didn't just reject them and strike them all dead. He still forgave them, allowed them to go into the land. But it just shows how a little attitude like this can progress and get worse and worse and worse. It's like cancer. You know, cancer starts out at stage one, which is pretty benign, and then stage two is malignant and slow growing. Stage three is malignant and faster growing, and then stage four typically is just out of control. It's just spreading everywhere. And I kind of equate that to what happened at the end in Numbers, the people just completely rebelling against God at Baal Peor and rebelling against him, and theoretically could have really lost their chance to finally go into land after 40 years, after that whole generation died away. So it's a cautionary tale for us as we look at that and think we wouldn't want to get to that kind of a consequence in our own lives. So let's review this and pull it together and kind of pull the different threads we've talked about. As we saw in James, this attitude of self-seeking comes from below, not above. Verse 15, he had written, in chapter 3, he wrote, "This wisdom does not ascend from above, but is earthly, sensual, and demonic." And the word there that really jumped out at me is the middle one, where the word really means like an animal. We don't want to be just like an animal, ruled by our instincts that, well, I just can't help myself. We need to implement God's way in our heart that governs what we do and say, our actions, so that we walk according to that every day. It's not an attitude of self. It's an attitude of selflessness, really thinking about others, not ourselves. Now, we had some great examples here of certainly of the wrong way. We looked at Miriam in Numbers 12. As an example of what envy and self-seeking can do, even that she rebelled against her own brother, Moses. And then a good example, on the other hand, of Moses in Numbers 11, who said, you know, I'm not trying to hold on to this special relationship with God. I want everyone to have this. He wanted to share. He really had an outward attitude of selflessness. This is a wonderful example. Now, of course, Moses is really a type of Christ. And Christ is the ultimate example of selflessness. So this topic would not be complete without finishing in Philippians. So I do want to go over to Philippians, read about our ultimate example of this attitude that we should have, and that's in Philippians 2. Let's read Philippians 2 and verses 1 through 4. This is our ultimate example. We want to put on Christ in our hearts and minds, in our way of life, and everything that we do. Philippians 2 really makes this clear. Philippians 2 and verse 1. "Therefore, if there is any consolation in Christ, if any comfort of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and mercy, fulfill my joy by being like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit." And we've read about that plenty today. "Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others." That is our wonderful example of what we need to follow. And then, of course, in verse 5, it makes it very clear that we need to put on this attitude into our own hearts. Verse 5, "Let this mind be in you, which also was in Christ Jesus." We need to put on that attitude, that mind of Christ that we just read about. This is a great challenge, but we can, with God's Spirit in us, we need to put away the natural wisdom from below that we read about, which is envy, jealousy, and self-seeking, all these natural ways of the world, and the ways of our adversary, Satan the devil. And instead, we need to dedicate ourselves to putting on the mind of Christ, which is the wisdom from above, or selflessness. God is transforming us from being children of this world, which is below, to being children of God, born from above, taking on His characteristics in our hearts. That's what real, true conversion of our hearts is. Changing from self-seeking and envy and jealousy to really concern for others in a selfless way. That is the conversion that we need to go through. So let's let James have the last word, as a good pastor would have, by reading. I want to read verses 17 and 18 again, and then we'll go over to chapter 5 to close. So let's read chapter 3, verses 17 and 18 of James. James 3, verse 17. Here is the challenge for us. Chapter 3, verse 17. "But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Now the fruit of righteousness," all of those things we just read, "the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace." And then let's close in James 5, verses, James chapter 5, verses 7 and 8. I love the analogy here of a farmer growing fruit. That's what he mentions here in verses 7 and 8 of chapter 5. James writes, "Therefore be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth." And who is the farmer? The farmer is God. He's developing fruit in each one of us. He's watering us, helping us to change and be converted to His way. This farmer, God Himself, is waiting for the precious fruit of the earth and waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and latter rain. So you also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand.